back. Announcements for today. Keep mentioning course evaluations. I checked today and we're at the 47% completion rate. I'm going to try to sweeten the pot and say we get to 100% completion before December 5th when it closes. It's a week from today. I'll add 5 points to everybody's final grade. But it's anonymous. I don't know who did it. So only if we get to 100%, everybody gets it. So please do fill that out. Like I've been mentioning, it's important in developing this course, changing around the topics and how it flows. So I really value your feedback. I have overnighted some more mojos in. So if you are in need of a mojo, come see me after class. And as a reminder, the mojos and the interface boards need to be returned to me after. There'll be some 0 or 100% part of your grade on the competition. You return those things. Make sure you get them back by whenever the finals do, at the latest that day. Questions? Comments?
So, maybe it's just my, whenever I run the beer kind of just a straight line of your pot, like that you provide for the side and stuff, I can know your thing and it's done, but then if I change like one number,
shouldn't have changed that number.
Well, I rerun it, like just like I'd be able to do cycle one thing, like change file one number, and I recent cycle, regenerate binary file, or upload a binary file.
Then the logo won't work anymore. So, but that's not my logo, the one that's all shot. That's like that. So. I don't know. We'll have to look at it. Why don't you come by my office and see. Yeah. It depends on what number you're changing. There's a lot of numbers you can change in there. It's just the rising edge. It could be any number between 0 and max mod. It's not the power of 2. So. I don't know. Well, come by unless. Look at it and see what's happening there. Just say, I don't know. Perhaps something with your compilation if you're just running the original bit file.
Yeah.
Maybe if you, have you tried not sure changing model, anything? Have you tried just not changing anything and recompiling? See if that works.
So on the report, you want no explanations for like anything. You just want.
Yeah.
Okay. So if it doesn't work, you don't want us to say anything like that. What if we give you
like simulation?
Yeah. So if you're not able to complete part of the report, then put some explanation in there as to why. Other questions? Okay. Not. Plan for today is to wrap up on switch capacitor converters and move into discrete time modeling. So far, we've looked at for the 2-to-1 converter, the slow switching limit model. We had a 2-to-1 transformer and this 1/4 C fly FS output impedance. The fast switching limit model, where we had same transformer and now a resistance that's equal to whatever resistance we see in the capacitor charging loop. It's 2-to-1. It looked like 2 device on resistances, any capacitor ESR, any other trace ESR. And those were fine based on our original analysis, but when we started looking at more complicated things like the Dixon converter, it can be a little bit more of a mess to try to figure out what this on resistance is,
by going each cap and looking at the delta V on it, solving that, and then figuring out the losses, manipulating that. So that started talking about this charge vector analysis, which looks at the normalized charge flows throughout the converter, and then uses those to drive kind of a general form for the output resistance to define some new variables here. This A vector is normalized charge flows in every element in the converter, and the voltage on each of those elements. And then based on this Telgen's theorem, which derives from KVL and KCL, and volt second balance or cap charge balance, you can kind of push these things together, solve for using this output impedance test case, generally what the SSL output resistance is of a switch capacitor converter containing only voltage sources and capacitors. In the class, was this summation of this A for each of our capacitors, where A is the charge flow in this case, it doesn't matter whether subinterval one or subinterval two, because by cap charge balance, those two are the negative of each other, and we're squaring it. So if I use the A sub C in subinterval one or the A sub C in subinterval two, they're the same magnitude, just negatives of one another, and when I square them, it's going to come out to the same thing. So I can use either Roman numeral one or Roman numeral two here, it doesn't matter, divided by the capacitance of each of those capacitors and the switching frequency. Okay. So in a rush to get through that result at the end of class, let's look at actually applying it. The important thing here is going to be deriving these normalized charge vectors, these A vectors. And formally, what are my rules? These A sub CI and subinterval one and subinterval two are defined by two things. One, KCL has to work throughout the converter. So when I look at the charge flow through any capacitor, look at the nodes on either side, KCL has to apply to those nodes. And second, because we have capacitors operating in periodic steady state in this converter, we need to have the sum of the charge going through it equal to zero at the end of the period. For a two interval converter, that means we're just saying it's A sub C for each capacitor in subinterval one is the negative of what it is in subinterval two. Put some current through it in the first subinterval, I got to pull that much current back through it in the other direction of the second subinterval so that its ripple will start and end at the same voltage or in steady state. Okay. So I can write all of those equations for the cap charge balance and all of my KCL and cram together, have a linear system and solve it. Right? And that's generally how you would find these A vectors. Turns out that more often than not, you can just kind of stare at the converter, figure out what they are pretty simply. So we'll show a couple examples of that without having to write down a big system of equations. Okay, so it's going to be pretty simple in our 2-to-1 switch cap converter. And we're going to approximate the output voltage as just constant. Replace this output capacitor and resistor. And then our A1 is again equal to Q in subinterval 1, Q fly in subinterval 1, Q out in subinterval 1. Divided by QL. So the charges in subinterval one through my three elements now I have is input source, output source, applying capacitor, only one switch capacitor, and normalized by QL with no superscript, meaning the total charge over an entire switching period. So, what is that? Because this is going to get normalized by Q out, I can kind of just pick an arbitrary magnitude for one of these charges and start from there. And then do this in subinterval one and subinterval two, figure out what my sum of Q out one and Q out two is, and divide that back through. It doesn't matter where I started when I normalize back, I'm going to end up at the same point. And if I pick 100 here, I'm going to normalize by 100 at the alpha charge. If I pick 200 here, I'm going to normalize by 200 at the alpha charge. Everything's going to end up at the same point. Right? So what I'm going to do is I'm just going to pick an arbitrary charge. I'm going to say here, Q in this first subinterval is going to be the integral of the current that flows, well, based on sign convention, it's going to be the current here. For every element, define the current going into the positive of the voltage. So I'm going to say Qn is negative 1 in the subinterval. Just picking that number completely arbitrary, I'm making it negative because I want power to come out of this thing. And Qn is going to be defined going into that source. Okay. So that's just arbitrary choice. But from there, I can say, okay, Qn is negative 1, that means I have Q total charge flowing out of this input source. That charge is going to go through C supply and through V, because I now only have one loop in this converter. That means Q supply is going to be 1, and Q out is going to be 1. And then this whole thing is still going to be divided by Q out, which I don't know yet. I assumed 1 for Q out in subinterval 1, sum over both periods, and I have to look at A2 to find it. In subinterval 2, that's this circuit on the right. I'm going to have the same thing. Qn2, Qfly2, Qout2 over total Qout. So here, the input source is not connected. I'm going to say 0. And then I now have one loop. It has whatever charge goes through the alpha source, goes through C supply in the negative direction, right? Going into the positive of the output source. Charge flowing to the output means it comes around, flows in this loop, it's coming up negative through C supply. So I'm going to have the same charge and opposite polarity on these. So we'll say whatever charge is positive at the output, negative on C supply. And I need to pick a magnitude for it, and it's arbitrary, I'm going to get normalized. But I know that cap charge balance is going to apply to C supply. Because I picked this magnitude in subinterval 1 where Q fly was 1, I better make it negative 1 for things to balance out. That's how the magnitude choice links between these two. That would have to match up. Okay. So I'm going to put negative 1 here and positive 1 here. That makes sense? Now I can say my total Q out is Q out 1 plus Q out 2. That's 1 plus 1 is 2. And then I can go back and divide these and normalize. So with that, now I can say that A1 is equal to minus 1 half, 1 half, 1 half. A2, 0, minus 1 half, 1 half. Okay, and those are my two charge vectors. I can also look at Qn1 plus Qn2. Get my total input charge. That's the first element in both of these, which would be minus a half and 0. So this is, well, minus a half when I've divided by Q out already. I use my normalized. Thank you. these green ones, it's minus a half and zero. That is my total input charge when normalized by Q out. Minus a half, the negative is from my reference polarity. That means that Q in is flowing out of VG. And the one half then is the ratio of my output current to my input current, which tells me that indeed this is a 2-to-1 converter. I didn't already know that inherently just by having seen this thing before. By looking at Q in and Q out, I can figure out what the ideal conversion ratio is. Right. Assuming it's reasonably efficient, then the ratio of the input and output current is inverse of the ratio of the input and output voltage. Okay. All right, so now that I have those, I can then plug into my formula here and solve the output resistance. So in the slow switching limit, ROSSL is going to be equal to the sum of all of my caps. I only have one in this case, of A sub CI squared over CIFS. And here, I have one half and minus one half, so it doesn't matter whether I pick AI or AII, A1 or A2. When I square one half and minus one half, I'm going to get a quarter either way. So this is equal to 1/4 over C fly FS, 1/4 C fly FS, which is why I included this slide, what we got previously, 1/4 C fly FS. Okay, let's do a more complicated one. Let's look at this Dixon converter and go through and solve the SSL output resistance of this thing. Use the same process, say AI equal to Q in 1. QC1, 1, QC2, 1, many as I have QC5, 1, QOut, 1, over QOut, and then A2, the same thing in the second subinterval. So this is the equivalent circuit in 1, the equivalent circuit in 2. And I can make a somewhat arbitrary pick to start and then just define everything with reference to that original choice. I'll normalize that magnitude out later. It's not going to matter. So let's again start from the input and just say this is minus one. Okay. There's no particular reason why I'm starting from the input. I could start from anywhere, start from the output. To pick something and then define everything correct for that. So Q in, again, is the charge that flows this way. So Q in being minus one means I have one charge flowing this way. That'll go through C5, give me one charge through C5. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And then I need to figure out what's going on with these four capacitors in the output. Say that once I say one unit charge flows through C5 in this interval, subinterval one, I'm going to need to have a minus one in it in subinterval two for things to work out here by cap charge balance. C1, C2, C3, C4, C5. So we need to have a minus one here. I have minus one charge going through C5. One charge goes through C4. Which means back here, I'm going to have minus one charge in C4. It's going to mean one charge in C3. C3 is going to need to match to C2. C2 is going to need to match to C1. So they're going to end up being all the same magnitude, just polarities based on their direction. I'm going to have Q flowing through each of these branches. It's positive through C5. Here it's negative in C4, positive in C3. Positive in C1, negative in C2. I sum up those and I get 3 units of charge at the output. Then in subinterval 2, I'm going to have the same thing, Q, Q, Q. C5 is negative, C4 is positive, negative, positive, negative, 3 charge at the output, in this case 0 at the input because it's disconnected.
Guys, by looking into these things, said fundamentally what we just did there was combined cap charge balance and KCL, the equations that we get out of them, right? I knew that I could jump between these two, saying the same charge that goes through C5 is going to have to flow through C5 negative here by cap charge balance. It has to average to 0. And by KCL, C5, whatever current comes out of it goes through C4 here. These 3 currents have to sum to the output charge. It's all just KCLs and cap charge balance. But don't need to actually write all those equations out. So those are my 2 vectors. Now I can see Q out is Q out in subinterval 1 plus Q out in subinterval 2 is 3 plus 3 is 6. So then I can normalize these, dividing everything by 6. Minus 1 over 6, 1 over 6, minus 1 over 6, 1 over 6, minus 1 over 6, 1 over 6, 1 half. That one took me a second. 0 minus 1 over 6, dot, 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 minus 1 over 6, 1 half. Okay, so in my normalized vectors here, A sub 1, A sub 2, or A sub 1. Once I've normalized, my normalized output charge is unity, which is the basis of my normalization. Normalized input charge is 1/6. So this is a 6-to-1 converter. Looking here and here, Q in over Q out is equal to 1 over 6. So this is a 6-to-1 converter. And that's what we got before. The Dixon that we've been looking at in class is a 6-to-1 implementation. And this thing can grow up and down. If I add more caps and more switches, I can make the Dixon a higher or lower conversion ratio. But the one we've been looking at is a 6-to-1 implementation. Okay, and then the output resistance, SSL, is the sum over all my caps of A sub CI squared over CIFS. Okay, what is that? Assuming all of my capacitances are the same value,
C, C fly, whatever we want to call it, but they're all the same. And I can say it's going to be the sum of these 5 1/6 terms squared. So it's going to look like 5/36, 1/C fly, FS. If C1, C5, C fly, same thing. Okay. So that, nice and easy. Questions on that? Okay, well then that solves our SSL output resistance. We can get the FSL output resistance as well with a slight modification of this method. So for the SSL output impedance, we're assuming this thing operates in this low switching limit where all the losses are just due to the delta Vs on the caps. Okay. And want to see delta V squared energy loss every time we short a cap to a voltage source charged by delta V. And going to the FSL, meaning we're switching much faster than the RC dynamics of this thing, that was the case where we have nearly constant current. Up here, our FSL model, we're switching so fast relative to the RC dynamics that in each subinterval we have nearly constant current, and then the losses end up really just depending on I squared R, whatever that current is, going through the equivalent charging resistance. For FSL modeling, wherever we are here, I'm assuming that resistance is the FET resistance. But the resistance in these charging loops is dominated by the FET resistance. If I have things like significant capacitor ESR, I can add that in to the method either by distributing it among the FETs and just increasing their effective resistance, or by adding it as a separate term here. But we'll solve out just assuming it's the on resistance of the device that dominates this charging resistance. Okay. So to do this, I'm going to need to define here, new term, A sub R vector, which is going to be Q sub R over Q out. It's going to again be one of these normalized charge vectors where Q sub R, let's say I, the ith element of this QR vector, is going to be the charge that flows through switch I when it is on. You'll notice that here I don't have any kind of subinterval 1 or subinterval 2 superscript, because I'm defining this as the charge that goes through it when it's on, whether that's in subinterval 1 or subinterval 2. I don't have to define separately subinterval 1 and subinterval 2. It's going to be conducting in one and not conducting in the other. It's going to be the vector of what actual charge goes through it when it is on, regardless of what interval that's in. Okay. So these charges are generally going to be found once you've found what we already have, all of the A sub C's, the charges that go through the caps. Really done with the hard part here. The charges through the switches are just going to be some linear combination of those. This converter, this equivalent circuit, I have some switch right here, so its charge is going to be equal to the charge that went through C4. At worst, I'm going to have two different capacitors charges going through a single switch. Then I'd have to add them up. But really, I've already found all of this. I just have to add up these elements in the right way to get this A sub R vector. So these are some linear combination. Of the A sub A1 and A2 that we've already found for the capacitors and the input source and output source. Okay. And then when we're in FSL, the assumption is going to be that all of the currents are constant within any given subinterval. So much faster than the RC dynamics of my flying capacitors, but the currents just look constant in subinterval one, and they can change value, but are also constant in subinterval two. And we're going to use this new normalized charge vector based on the switches to solve what the total conduction losses are in the resistances of the circuit. And then that's going to give us what the output resistance is. It's the output resistance is modeling that conduction loss now. Okay, so let's say I sub RI is the current in switch I when it's conducting. That's going to be related to the total charge that flows through that switch, where the total charge is the current times the amount of time. Right? So I sub RI is going to be equal to Q sub RI times 1 over the time, which is going to be 2 over TS, where TS is my switching period. The 2 comes into play because I'm assuming 2 switching subintervals, and that switches on during one of them. Right? So if I flow a total charge Q in subinterval 1, that's half the total switching period. I sub RI times TS over 2, that total charge. Okay. And the power lost from that, power loss in switch I due to conducting this current is going to be whatever that current is times its on resistance times 1/2, where the same argument, this is my D, right? It's on for half the period as I squared R for half the switching period. So my total power loss is I squared R times 1/2. Okay, now I'll plug in for I sub RI. And I'll get Q sub RI times 2 over TS squared R on I 1/2 is going to be equal to 4 divided by 2 will give me a 2. And I'm going to rewrite my 1 over TS as FS squared. Q sub RI squared times FS squared times 2 R on I. Okay. And what I'm going to do is replace this QRI with ARI times QL. I normalized times what I normalized by. That'll give me ARI times QL squared, FS squared, 2R on. We'll distribute this square, both terms, RI squared, Q out squared. Then this thing here, Q out squared, FS squared, total charge delivered to the output times the switching frequency is the output current. Right. This is I out squared. So this whole thing, the power loss in resistor I, looks like A sub RI squared times 2R on I times I out squared. Some term times the square of the output current. That term looks like a resistor at the output. Right? R out times I out squared is the power loss in an output resistor. Right? So that means that this contributes, my I switch contributes an output resistance of A sub RI squared times 2R on. Now all I need to do is sum that up over all of my different switches to get the total output resistance. That's going to give the final result, R out and FSL is equal to the sum over all of my switches of 2R on I A sub RI squared. Example, applying that to the 2-to-1 switch capacitor converter, and then that'll be it for switch cap. And we'll go to the board. Okay. Here's a 2-to-1 switch capacitor converter. All I need to do is get this A sub R vector, which is the charges that go through each of my four switches when they're on. In sub interval one, I have pop switch and this third switch on, connecting from the input through C fly through the output to get this equivalent circuit.
Well, I already found all the charges associated with those. I know that a charge of magnitude 1/2, once normalized by Q out, flows in this path in subinterval one.
Means I'm gonna have positive 1/2 for this top device, my total charge that flows through when it's conducting, normalized by the output, and then negative 1/2 for this device. Signs aren't really going to matter here because I'm going to end up squaring all these things anyway.
Okay. So my A sub R is going to be Q through M1, Q through M2, Q through M3, Q through M4, when each is on, divided by Q out.
So I could go back here and say, okay, unit charge one flowed through this, and then have to figure out what Q out is and normalize it, or I can just use the values that I already normalized. So I did here, said I already know I have 1/2 normalized through 1 and 3 in subinterval 1.
and half, minus and half. Then in subinterval 2, I have, let's see, I have 1 half going to the output. It comes off C fly here. So that means it's flowing this direction through Q2, this direction through my bottom device, which means these other two charges are going to be 1 half minus 1 half. So with that, to the switches, I can find my total output impedance, I times A sub RI squared. Here is my A sub R vector. You sum up the square of all of these terms, they're all in half, the square of all of them is 1/4, I have 4 of them. Sum of all those squares is going to be 1. Assuming they all have the same on resistance, I'll get 2 R on. Okay. What did we get before? Back here. So the output resistance is R, which is whatever the total resistance is in the charging path. In both of the charging paths, I went through 2 FETs in my loop, which means that total resistance is 2 R on, assuming only the switches have on resistance, means that matches what we got before. We are not going to go through and do it for the Dixon converter. I won't have time. Okay. Questions on anything related to switch cap? Okay. Now, we'll move into introduction to kind of our final topic of the course, which is this discrete time modeling. So as a reminder, the kind of motivation we did for this was, what are the analysis methods we've looked at so far? So we've looked at averaging extensively in previous courses, and then just did a little bit with all of this cap charge balancing leading to charge vector analysis, right? And then in this course, we spent a fair amount of time developing state plane analysis and looked briefly at sinusoidal analysis. And these cover different types of applications, but are fundamentally limited by the assumptions that these analysis methods make in order to simplify calculation, right? So sinusoidal analysis, we had to assume IQ bandpass tank. And then neglect all harmonics. Assume that all waveforms are purely sinusoids at the switching frequency. And it'll be a reasonable approximation for any converter where the majority of the waveforms look like sinusoids at the switching frequency or pretty close to them. State plane analysis, a little more accurate in some cases, but still built fundamentally on the assumption that we have a single frequency resonance with no resistance in each individual subinterval. So here, each subinterval becomes 1L, 1C at most, or a non-resonant subinterval, less than 1L, 1C, this voltage source is an L, current source is C's. Okay. In some cases, it was a little more accurate than the sinusoidal analysis. In sinusoidal analysis, we need a single frequency over the entire switching period.
estate plan analysis needed a 1L1C resonance, which means there is a single resonant frequency, but just for that subinterval, and it can change between subintervals. But we couldn't do things like add resistance in there because that makes things spiral down, and then the whole concept of state plane analysis is not so useful. So they're not circles. Why do you need to sketch them? It's just differential equations at that point. Okay. And then all of these averaging techniques are fundamentally built on the idea that we have kind of small ripple analysis on cap charge balancing that we just looked at, assumed relatively small ripple in each of the caps. And then everything back here, applied volt second and cap charge balance, small ripple approximation to all filter elements. This works well with small straight line ripple. Want the ripple to be small, and we want things like the inductor current to look like a triangle wave where I can approximate the ripple as just Vg minus V out over L. Small ripple to all other elements when I'm looking at the ripple on the same wave. That fundamentally is a limitation. It just took out any sort of resonant behavior in the circuit. Okay, so why? And can we get away from having to have these type of assumptions? And the answer is yes. We're going to look at how and where it comes from. So fundamentally, each of these methods is meant to deal with the situation that we have in power electronics. We're looking at switched circuits, right? Back to basics. What's difficult about analyzing power converters as opposed to any other circuit is the switching nature of it. Just a buck here, single pole dual throw switch. In all of these methods, we're approximating as within any given switching position, we have some linear equivalent circuit. All right, so when the switch is in position one, it becomes a short here and an open here. I end up with this thing, which is just sources and passive elements, some linear equivalent. Switch is in position two, it changes, but it's still some linear equivalent circuit. And these things individually should be able to analyze now. If you're graduate students in EE, any sort of just linear source and passive circuit, you can, in many different ways, Laplace or differential equations, however you want, fully analyze the circuit and write down expressions for all the voltages and currents in it. Right? The only thing that's difficult is this part here, which causes you to jump between this circuit and this circuit back and forth. That's really the only thing unique to switch mode power supplies. So, how to go about dealing with that? And I'm going to talk, before I introduce discrete time modeling, about historically a couple of methods that have been used to deal with this. First, comes from Dr. Slobodan Chuk, who was a student of Professor Middlebrook at Caltech. His thesis in 1976 really formalized averaging as we use it today. It's developed according to state-space analysis, which we're going to review and look at first. Averaging had been applied before this thesis. People have predated Dr. Chu, but this is really the one that put everything together and showed how to apply averaging to general PWM converters, develop equivalent circuit models, and so on. And when he developed it, that he did it using state-space analysis. I'm going to go back through this briefly, talk about where this came from, and then I'm going to contrast it with discrete time modeling, which was actually developed around the same time, but uses a smaller number of approximations to arrive at a result that isn't constrained by having to have small ripple. I gave a seminar on this at the current course about history that goes through this a little bit more rapidly than I will in the class. I'll post the link to that on the website. If you want to see things that have more rapid pace without annotations, just jumping through slides. We'll pick up here. We'll talk a little bit about averaging and then about contrasting it with discrete time modeling, where the assumptions come in and what you've seen in averaging, and how we can develop a modeling method devoid of them with discrete time modeling. And we'll start that next class and hopefully make it through by the end.